political commentators, and today we welcome Trish Sherson in the Auckland studio. Good morning, Trish. She'll be connected up in a moment, I hope. Stephen Mills is in the Wellington studio. Good morning, Stephen.
Morning, Catherine.
Stephen is the Executive Director of UMR Research, a former political advisor to two Labor governments. Trish is from the corporate affairs firm Sherson Willis and a former ACT Party press secretary. Can you hear me, Trish?
I certainly can.
That's wonderful. Hey, look, let's start with this, especially off this morning's Morning Report interview with the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, continuing to hold the line that she is not in a position of needing to comment or criticise on the New Zealand First Foundation photo saga, that that is a matter for another party leader, despite the fact that party leader is her Deputy Prime Minister. The Greens have kind of tippy-toed towards saying something, but at the moment it's hands off on criticism. Trish, is this sustainable?
I don't think it's sustainable, and I don't think it's credible. You know, you've had a sort of last week started out with the Prime Minister at the post-cabinet presser, and the question was, did she trust Winston Peters? And she sort of skirted around that, and then the next day she tried to be a bit stronger on that, and then she backed him last week. And then I thought this morning's interview, it just sounded like you were absolutely sprawling on the head of a pin. I think the bigger point around this is that for New Zealand First, you put the ins and outs of it to one side. Every election, there is something that blows up around New Zealand First, and New Zealand First supporters are like Trump supporters. That just galvanises them around Winston, and, you know, it's always the media having a crack at them. The real damage here is going to be done to the Prime Minister particularly, and then Labour and their sort of reputation around this. And, you know, I just don't think that going into this election campaign with the polls so tight, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, that they can afford not to have a clear position on this.
Stephen?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt the donation scandals put both Labor and New Zealand First on the back foot, and at the moment anyway, the proof of it will be on election night, I guess, or when the specials come in. The Simon Bridges call to rule New Zealand First out looks good. I mean, Labor will be much... would have much preferred to be building on the success of the infrastructure and homeless policy announcements, and said they're still engaged in what really has been an endless pantomime during this government of being heavily criticised and pursued by journalists to criticise New Zealand First politicians, primarily Shane Jones, of course. But in this case, New Zealand First as a whole, and the Prime Minister being unwilling to do so, because the obvious impact of that, the likely impact of that would be the collapse of the coalition. Now, as for the photo itself, and I realise absolutely there's some serious issues involved in the New Zealand First donations, but for that photo to be described as a chilling effect on democracy, I think it's laughable. It sort of reminded me of what Ricky Gervais has been saying about actors. I've been assured by New Zealand First sources that the photo was opportunistic, and you had a situation where probably New Zealand's most famous journalist was in the CBD of Tauranga with a former New Zealand First president and had his photo taken. I mean, I don't think there's any surprise on
what
that.
What about the other journalist whose face wouldn't be known to
anybody?
Well,
was it independently taken? Or
I understand it,
but
yes.
But he was with the New Zealand First president, presumably.
Look, the point is...
But I mean,
what you had, though, you had the leader of New Zealand First, Winston Peters, who happens to be the Deputy Prime Minister, initially saying on another radio station, we had taken the photos to show the sort of thing that was going on. Now, he's walked that back. But hang on a minute.
And the blog,
and then they end up on a blog that has similarities to the attack blogs of 2014.
Look, I think there was some...
This is not just a whoopsie photo.
There was poor judgment there, but I think when the point I was really making, not that that was all right what happened afterwards, but that journalists were the target. I think, as Audrey Young, you know, the always excellent Audrey, pointed out, it wasn't the journalists that were the target, it was Lester Gray that was the target. And if anyone should feel intimidated, it's him. But then I think you've got to look at this, that New Zealand First is essentially at war here for their survival. I mean, this isn't like a pure whistleblower who thinks something murky has happened in the New Zealand First Foundation, probably with, you know, reason given the information that's come out, and has extracted information and taken it to the police or the Electoral Commission, and then decisions will be making. This is a political campaign in which information is either being drip-fed by the source within New Zealand First or by the journalists who have all that information week by week, which instead of kind of allowing an overall judgment on whether this is dodgy but legal or dodgy but illegal, is actually putting kind of, you know, insane levels of pressure on New Zealand First and seeking to destroy them.
Isn't that what investigative journalism does? And look, the thing is, the question is,
yes,
Stephen,
no.
what are the rules of that war? And are the rules of that war that you can now go and take photographs, and accidental or not, being surveilling people doing their work and then take them to attack blogs? Is that now acceptable behaviour?
I think the attack blog was completely unacceptable, and it was an odd thing to do, and I don't know what the thinking was, why a National Party aligned blog would, I guess I kind of got breaking news, so it made it worthwhile, but that seemed very odd, and it was clearly the communications of it were mishandled by Winston Peters. But I think the overall thing of a supporter taking a photo in that situation, you know, isn't kind of some attack on democracy, which is really the point I was trying to make there.
Yeah, I guess what it illustrated for me, though, and again, it comes back to Winston's comment, you know, this is to show the sort of thing that's going on. I mean, the sort of thing that's going on, as everyone has known for weeks, is that there has been a huge, you know, leak of information out of New Zealand First, clearly driven by some kind of discipline breakdown within the party. And the sort of thing that is going on is that they are working with a journalist. It's been no secret that it's gone because he's made the running on the whole story, and it's a journalist then doing his job. So to me, that defence also, or that line from Winston also just kind of summed up what we saw last week, which was a really, I thought, a very ham-fisted attempt to manage this whole thing, which sort of culminated in that quite ludicrous Facebook Live
Q&A.
Piece. Yeah, the Q&A with Winston. And you know, the only thing that came out of it was more sort of entertainment value than any sort of enlightenment around what was actually going on. And I was really, you know, had to chuckle to myself that the majority of the comments were people saying that they couldn't hear. So I thought, you know, it also made me question New Zealand First's sort of strong use of social media and whether, in fact, that's a platform that their supporters are actually up to.
I think the kind of issue isn't that photo, even though clearly it was clumsily handled. It's what the Electoral Commission said about whether the donations to the foundation should have been donations to the party and reported the New Zealand First accounts. And also I think there's, you know, on the face of it, you know, it's sort of early days for that, I guess, but on the information about racing, whether some donations have been bundled, effectively a donation from one person of a lot more than 15,000 split up through closely related entities. They are the issues.
Yeah, but the point is, the Prime Minister's statements with respect to when she has a responsibility for matters pertaining to her ministers, and when she was asked this morning whether Mr Peters can, and she can form her opinion on it, right? But what she's saying is not issuing an opinion on it. What she is saying is that it is not her issue, that it is her issue for another party. When she was asked about the conduct, when she was asked about the cabinet manual, no, I don't see these things as being explicit to the cabinet manual, which is the conduct of how we run the government. At what point is the Prime Minister's response relevant to the behaviour and actions of her ministers, or is it carte blanche?
Well, I think more importantly, when are the actions of her ministers relevant to the Prime Minister and her personal brand? Because I think that's a bigger issue for Jacinda. And don't forget, she let out a couple of weeks ago around, you know, the Facebook advertising new so-called transparency rules, which aren't really about content, they're about targeting and spend. But she has set herself up for this election to go in as the person who's going to run a clean fight and, you know, trying to really paint National into the corner that they'll be the ones running a dirty and unfair campaign. Well, what we saw this morning just doesn't add up to that, because in the public's view, when it's your deputy prime minister, regardless of whether they're in another party, that does mean you expect the prime minister to make a call on that behaviour.
It is a really complicated situation, that who has responsibility for this. And there's some really interesting tweets this morning from Dr. Dean Knight, a professor of law at Victoria, on how different standards apply depending on the hat of which someone's wearing, and the standards as he argued anyway, hopefully I'm paraphrasing this correctly, you know, are lower in terms of their kind of private roles and their party roles as opposed to being a minister. And that's, I think, something worth keeping in mind. I mean, I don't doubt for a moment that being kind of put under pressure by journalists to condemn New Zealand First and essentially kind of evading it, not answering questions directly, doesn't help the Prime Minister. And it is very much a judgment call on how much you protect that brand and how much you risk the coalition collapsing, which would also have obvious political consequences.
Well, the Greens are in the same boat, sort of saying something and sort of not, directly criticising another member of the coalition at the same time. But they have a brand to protect too, Trish. And I guess the thing is, if this was a one-off, it was this week and gone next week. But we have flagged well in advance of 2020 election year that issues may arise. There are any number of ways by which they might arise around New Zealand First, and I'm sure political opponents will be going looking hard for them. And is she going to stick to the same line every time, or is there a different tack to take without collapsing the coalition?
Well, it's a really difficult one. I mean, I think the problem with this one is that it is not something that she can really resolve quickly. I mean, the underlying matter requires an investigation, and that's going to take some time. So that you do have to make a call. But I think, you know, it's one of those things where if the media particularly keeps seeing this sort of you know, there's a lack of clarity around the position, it seems to change, that's when the real issues for Labour are going to come up, not least of which means that they are, as Stephen said, they are on the back foot in what should be their time to really start rolling out their election platform. And it also, and I did see Simon Bridges make this point this morning, and you might say, oh yeah, well, you would say that, but I do think this is right, that, you know, if this had been around a national government and a partner in the national government, you know, they would have been absolutely hammered over something like this.
Let's talk about, I just want to touch on that Conway Brunton poll. It came out about this time last week. We were discussing it. Stephen, I know you want to pick up on it because it is relevant, because what it shows, and this is not inconsistent with other results, is the tightest of tight elections. And actually, much of it depending on whether New Zealand First gets over that 5% threshold or gets through with another lifeline. Our assumption has to date always been that in the heat of an election campaign, they will get up and over 5%. There's only been once it didn't happen, ironically after a year of some scandal.
And they were smashed that year over and over and over again and still got 4.1 or 2%.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So let's pick up. What did you want to revisit the Colmar Brunton over in the context of what we're talking about?
Well, I just thought we'd run through the polls as they come because they aren't too often. I mean, the Colmar Brunton had National 46, Labour 41, Greens 5, New Zealand First 3, and ACT on 2. And it's the third Colmar Brunton in a row, which would have National in government. The last two in 2019 were the same. It certainly shows ACT has a pulse. If you look at the News Hub earlier, that one was kinder to Labour, but was also really close. And, you know, as you've already previewed, you know, we're really down to where New Zealand First is, could decide the election. So Simon Bridges' call might either be the most brilliant one made by a party leader or a reckless gamble which condemned him, finished him as a politician.
What it's done is leave him free now to criticise New Zealand First and make it a target, Trish.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They were doing that anyway.
True.
That is, I think he will feel freed by this because he's not now on the back foot always answering questions about New Zealand First when he wants to talk about other things. But I do think actually the ACT, you know, as you said, they're getting a pulse back is interesting. And if you think about Seymour now with the euthanasia referendum at the election, he has got a platform that he has never had before heading into an election aside from running in Epsom, that's going to give him even more profile in the lead up to the election. So I think, the ACT more than New Zealand First this time round is the bit of the wild card.
The tax issue, we were just surmising last week in a discussion whether having gazumped National somewhat on infrastructure with the announcement that it made and National really left flailing and going, hang on a minute, they were all our ideas, but not much else, whether Labour might also strategically consider neutralising another issue between the parties, which is tax. I am not sure how much room it has to move either politically or fiscally. National today is certainly in less than an hour's time going to outline a broad framework for tax cuts. How much are they going to feature Trish or not in this campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right. It is more difficult for Labor on the tax issue. But I do think where they will try and hammer National, ironically, is around fiscal responsibility. So, you know, National will come out with their plan. It's probably going to be, without costings. And so Labor's opportunity then will be to say, hey, look, well, we are fiscally responsible. We've proved that over this term. You guys have got all these big spending plans and infrastructure and tax, but none of them are going to be costed. So in a way, it's going to be an interesting sort of flip on the campaign last time round, all based around fiscal responsibility. But I don't see Labor coming out with a huge tax cut package. I mean, I just don't think in their current position and trying to shore up their really core base that would play well for them.
It is difficult to target one that is at the lower end of the tax scale without benefiting the upper end of the tax scale. That is always the challenge for Labor and tax cuts.
That's what happens with a tax-free threshold. Everybody gets it. Yeah, John Key's had a lot of... John Key. His name misread so often. John Key got a lot of credit. It used to annoy me intensely whenever he stole what was seen as Labor policy, and the journalists would go crazy saying he's wrong-footed Labor, put them on the back foot and so on. And that happened with Labor with the infrastructure package. But I hope we don't get addicted to that kind of political game. I mean, there may be fiscal room for tax cuts, but there's a lot of uncertainties with coronavirus and so on. And the difficulty is, you know, we've talked about this before, of doing anything meaningful, it just blows the budget, you know. And if you're kind of offering people $10 a week, which is the usual tax cut that comes in that kind of middle income level, which is most sensitive to tax levels, well, then they kind of just say, oh, that'll be useful, but it'll be taken away by someone else, and they're not going to storm the political barricades for $10 a week. If National does something much more bold and radical, well, then that gives opportunity, obviously, Labor to fight on. You know, there have to be cuts to pay for it, and they'll be able to kind of talk about the impact on health and housing and education and so on, and even potentially on fiscal responsibility, on saying that Labor's the better party on keeping the debt down. I mean, I don't sort of pay too much attention. National's constantly talking about tax cuts without giving any numbers or figures at all, which Labor would be absolutely hammered for. The Troika, you know, Key, English and Joyce did that over and over again, even during the 2014 election campaign. So I think until we actually see numbers, there's no reason to take that seriously.
And I doubt we'll see numbers today. And Trish, the other point that exposes Labor is that it had a working group, one of its, you know, many, many working groups, come back and say it should be spending billions more on raising benefit levels. This is the party that has a focus on child poverty. So it would be exposed on two flanks if it moved on tax cuts for earners and did not move on that.
Yeah, and I think not least of which that, you know, tax, as we've seen for Labor, and it's normally been going the other way, trying to put another tax in, but it hasn't been a good election winner for them. So I think they would try and steer away from that this time as one of their major planks. I mean, I was just thinking about the other day, I saw a post from Jacinda Ardern, how things are now being summed up in those sort of three lines in an Instagram post, and actually the lead out from the government was around we are the government of infrastructure, and then two other more sort of social things came down the track. So that to me gave an interesting signal around where they really want to position themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely right. If you're talking tax in a campaign, that helps National, not Labor. One interesting thing will be how Labor does respond to indexation, because you know, it's a classic Mike Moore thing, isn't it? It works in theory, not in practice, because governments actually do need the kind of revenue from fiscal drag to meet the ever-increasing demands. But it's very hard to defend not having indexation of the tax scales.
Well, it was the chewing gum budget. Yeah. The chewing gum budget was about moving the thresholds. And it caused what it caused that year when it was exploded into something else, or built up into something else.
National's already announced that, so I guess Labor's got to have a clear position on that as well.
Well, you mentioned Mike Moore, and you just wanted to talk a little bit about him as well. Of course, I think it was it Friday, his funeral, and many people have had their take. Stephen, you were there and then, weren't you?
Yeah, and I mean, just while on the subject, I just want to note that he was personally very kind to me, even though my political career, I worked for David Longy and Helen Clark, I'm a direct political career. I don't think from all the obituaries I've read he's got sufficient credit for how well he campaigned in 1990 and 1993. In 1990, it's really hard to do counterfactuals, and in the end it was a landslide to National, so maybe replacing Moore with Palmer didn't work. But I'd say that 10, looking it up, the 10 of 29 seats that Labor held were won by under 1,000, and I think his much superior campaigning skills over Geoffrey Palmer, you could argue that he did save those seats. In 1993, coming off that landslide, he fought National basically to a deadlock, and it was really only Peter Tapsell's defection to become the Speaker which enabled that deadlock to be broken and for a government to be formed. That was the bug of the pollsters' election, and part of the reason I think Labor did get a late swing in that election was that National sort of packed up about Wednesday of the last week, and Mike Moore just fought through the night, endlessly campaigning right to the end, and I think that had a really sort of powerful impact on flicking that trend around. In 1996, and this has hardly been mentioned, everybody remembers the Jim Anderton, Helen Clark rapprochement, but in 1996 there were a couple of really critical photo opportunities during that campaign, which lifted our tracking. And also sort of just in that, going back to that 1991, the way that he kind of played it with all the kind of dominating the election with ideas like the compact and an idea card and floating, kind of reneging on the frigate deal. He kept pulling us up to a respectable position, and then we dropped down again. But I mean, it did make it better than just a complete kind of procession to a huge defeat. And the last quick thing I'd like to say is some kind of semi sort of lunatic left wing stuff about how he betrayed his class, and even that he was a patsy whose humble origins were used to lull the working class into accepting Rogernomics is just crazy. He wasn't an unprovoked cheerleader for Rogernomics at all. Like most ministers in the first term, he went with what was largely a return to orthodoxy and some sensible reforms, and he certainly wasn't on board when Rogernomics flowed into sort of health, education, unions and so on. And in the crunch, in the great wars between the Longy and Douglas, you know, for control of that government, he was actually really helpful to us. He often used to ring me with, you know, really kind of 1-2 sentences, really succinct advice, tell David to have a word with so-and-so, he's feeling unloved, he got this issue wrong, you know, run it this way, this is coming up, you know, it'd be a good thing for David to get on the front foot on, you know, and that was immensely helpful and by far the most useful advice I received from many people who offered their advice in that time.
The other thing, Trish, reflecting on it, is the number of people who are saying, where are our conviction politicians today?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, he was a very political creature.
Yeah. And I mean, I was only a teenager during those times that Stephen's talking about, but I do remember, Mike Moore and some of the more breakthrough ideas that he had even at that age. You know, you remembered them from the TV news and other things, and just what a sort of political figure he was, you know, and partly that was because, you know, someone made the analogy that he was similar in some ways to Shane Jones and the kind of sort of comments and things that would get picked up in the media. But I think overwhelmingly it is, what the one thing about it has been sort of the volume of commentary about Mike that has been a tribute to him, and it does make us all reflect upon the quality of the sort of the man and the politician and the contribution that he made.
Would you call him a conviction politician then? Yes, he was political.
Yes, I think he was. I mean, I think he was a convict. Everybody's on it. Politicians on a continuum of, you know, whether they're just there to kind of be things or there to do things. And I think he was towards the do things end. But at the same time, he was a really intense political animal who was really kind of enjoyed the political battle as well. It was a great funeral. It was, and it was a magnificent send-off with the Hark. It was fantastic.
And cross the party lines.
Seven,
as well.
All living National Party leaders were there, I think, all seven of them, from Macleay through to Simon Bridges attended, as well as a lot of others.
Thanks, both of you. Stephen Mills and Trish Sherson.